From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. Today, Public Health Radio presents the first in a two-part series on abortion and unintended pregnancy. On our next show, we'll speak with an opinion researcher and two pro-life activists to learn if there may be common ground that could unite most all Americans in the effort to reduce the number of abortions in the United States. Our guest on today's show is Jacqueline Derrick, and she will be discussing a major research study she participated in that attempted to determine why the United States has the highest abortion rate among nearly all the developed countries. Can we learn from these successes abroad? But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The following news update was compiled by Public Health Radio's news editor, Andrew Coates. Floods and other weather-related disasters account for just under 60% of all disasters suffered by humanity each year, according to the United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator, Margareta Wahlström. In recent months, flooding has affected over 45 million people in Pakistan, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh, causing over 2,200 deaths and ruining about 10 million acres of crops. Flooding has also caused crises in other nations in 2007, including Colombia, northern and southern Sudan, Britain, the United States, and other areas. Speaking at the United Nations, Wahlström linked the problem to global warming, deforestation, and other human activity. She also noted the numerous public health implications of flooding, including intestinal diseases caused by contaminated water, exposure due to loss of shelter, and malnutrition caused by the impact of flooding on agriculture. She is encouraging serious reflection on how to alter the human contribution to the problem of flooding, and predicted ever more devastation caused by flooding over the decades to come. More information is available at the website of the United Nations, UN.org. Last month, Portugal legalized abortion during the first 10 weeks of pregnancy. Formerly, Portugal allowed abortion only in cases of rape, to save the life of the woman, or in the event of serious fetal anomaly. Under the previous laws, there were an estimated 23,000 clandestine abortions in Portugal annually, and 10,000 Portuguese women sought abortion in Spain each year rather than face the risk of criminal prosecution. Under the new law, both medical and surgically induced abortions are permitted during the first 10 weeks of pregnancy. Although physicians may register as conscientious objectors and refuse to perform abortions, the law requires that women seeking abortion will receive a referral to a physician who will help them. Women who seek abortion must attend an educational session about contraception and family planning, as well as waiting through a 3-day reflection period before terminating their pregnancy. With the implementation of Portugal's new law, every country in Europe now permits women the right to seek abortion, with the exception of Ireland, where legal abortions occur only under extreme circumstances specified by law, and most women seeking abortion travel to England. More information can be obtained at the BBC's website, bbc.co.uk. Government subsidies that cut health insurance premium prices in half for people without health insurance would reduce the number of uninsured Americans by only 3%, according to a study issued by the nonprofit research organization, the RAND Corporation. In the United States, 46 million people lack health insurance. Proposals for reform that would reduce this number emanate from all points on the political spectrum. President Bush, most of the Republican presidential hopefuls, and several of the Democratic candidates have proposed generous tax breaks to subsidize the purchase of private health insurance policies. States like Vermont and Massachusetts have already made reforms that include such subsidies for low-income people. The RAND article's authors looked at new individual health insurance policy subscribers in California over 45 months and conducted telephone surveys with 4,000 of them, as well as 400 families that included an uninsured adult. Based on the study, Susan Marquis, a senior economist with RAND, one of the study's lead authors, predicted that subsidies to promote the purchase of private insurance policies are not going to be the tool that solves the problem of the uninsured. The authors also conclude that newer types of individual plans with very high deductibles may be attractive to healthy people, but these too are unlikely to help reduce the total number of people without health insurance, especially individuals who are actually ill and need insurance the most. Worthy of note is that most of the other 25 developed countries provide health insurance from birth to death for their entire populations and give the private insurance sector a very limited role. More information on the RAND study can be accessed through the RAND Corporation website, rand.org. Coming up next, a discussion about why the United States has the highest abortion rate of all the developed countries. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The United States is unique among all the developed nations in having among the poorest indicators in the area of maternal and child health, including the highest infant and maternal mortality rates and the highest rates of teen pregnancy. And in spite of the fact that the United States has the most active anti-abortion movement among all the developed countries, year after year, among every social stratum, the U.S. has the highest rate of abortion. Despite this fact, remarkably little attention has been paid to the characteristics and social policies in place in all the other developed countries that have allowed all of them to reduce their abortion rates. Today's guest, Jacqueline Darroch, was part of an international team of researchers that has completed a series of two studies comparing teen pregnancy and abortion in the U.S. to several other developed nations. On today's show, she will discuss the findings of that research that illuminates the cultural and political factors that have led to our uniquely high rate of unintended pregnancy and abortion. On next month's show, we'll discuss the issue with two activists in the pro-life movement and a public opinion researcher to learn if the various social groups active on the issue could carve out a consensus that would allow the U.S. to learn from the policies of other nations and lower our rates of abortion and unintended pregnancy. Jacqueline Darroch is a senior fellow in social demography at the Guttmacher Institute. Prior to that, she led the reproductive health grant-making program for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She has published over 100 articles on adolescent health and sexual behavior, women's reproductive health, and strategies for improving pregnancy outcomes. And she's received numerous awards and honors from the American Public Health Association, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and several other organizations active in the area of reproductive health. Jacqueline Darroch, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Hello.
Maybe we could start out by having you tell us about the study you participate in. that looks at teen sexuality and does an international comparison. Tell us about that. Who funded it and what were its goals?
Right. Well, this study of teen sexual and reproductive behavior across developed countries was one that the Guttmacher Institute carried out with funding from the Ford Foundation and the Kaiser Family Foundation. And it actually was a study where it was researchers from the United States at the Guttmacher Institute and then researchers from each of our study countries. The study countries that we used looking at the comparison in the United States and these other countries were Canada, France, Great Britain, and Sweden.
And have there been other studies of this type that compared sexual behavior cross-nationally among people in different countries?
Actually, this was not the first study, but a follow-up of one that we had carried out through the Guttmacher Institute in the early 1980s. And then we were actually quite surprised to discover how much higher teen pregnancy, birth, and abortion rates were in the United States than in many of the Western developed countries that we would think we might be comparable to. In the late 80s, actually, we also did a study looking at adult women, women into their 20s and even higher ages. In the study just looking at adults, we were surprised there to find that U.S. adults had higher rates of unintended pregnancy than adult women in Western developed countries. So in the study that was most recent, we went back to look at adolescents in the late 90s, around 2000, we compared adolescents in the United States with adolescents in other developed countries. And one of the questions we had was whether some of the differences we saw in the early 80s had now disappeared and these gaps had decreased, or had they still continued to exist. Well, and what we found was...
Well, how about if we start out with the United States, maybe? What in the United States... What percentage of pregnancies are unintended? Is that known?
Actually, we have fairly good time series of data about the intention status of pregnancies to women in the United States. And first of all, we have to remember that, although I have data for adolescents themselves, that unintended pregnancy is fairly common in the United States. About half of pregnancies in the United States are those that women either say in surveys were births that they did not want or pregnancies that end in abortion. And we put together pregnancies that were births that women said they didn't want that soon or at all and abortions to make an estimate of unintended pregnancies. Unintended pregnancies in the United States account for about half of all pregnancies. It's much higher among adolescents, so that about 80% or more of pregnancies to adolescents in the United States are pregnancies that they hadn't planned to have.
In terms of how one might handle an unintended pregnancy, you could have an abortion, you could continue the pregnancy and keep the baby, or you could give the baby up for adoption. And how does that break down in the United States, and are there differences among different age groups?
Yes, well, in the United States, about half of the unintended pregnancies end in induced abortion. Women decide to and are able to have abortions. And that varies, but not as much as one might think, across age groups. So that it's actually somewhat lower among adolescents. About 40% of pregnancies to women 15 to 19 end in abortion. And over half of pregnancies to older women end in abortion. Some of that actually may have to do with both who is becoming pregnant at those ages, but also access to abortion services.
Women who do not choose abortion, I assume that most of them are going to keep the pregnancy and not give the baby up for adoption. Is that known?
We have not very great data on the proportion of women giving birth who give babies up for adoption. But what is available shows us there have been some real changes, certainly since the early 70s. But it's very rare in the United States for, and the data we have are for never married women who become pregnant, go on and give a birth to then relinquish that baby for adoption. In the early 90s, it was about 1 to 2% of white women, and the level is much lower among African American women, and actually that's estimated to be well under 1%. So adoption, while it is something that occurs in the United States, is not a common way for young women or older women to deal with an unintended pregnancy. Either women have abortions or go on and give birth and parent the child.
So among these unintended pregnancies, which you're saying are so very common, what do women say about the reasons for them? Like, were they not using any contraception? Was it a failure of contraception? Is there a sense of that? What percentage were perhaps coercive sexual behavior or sexual assault on the part of an aggressive male? How does that break down?
Well, of course, you're asking good questions that we have some data on, but not as much as probably we'd like to know, in part because all the issues are quite complicated. But we look at it this way. In the United States, we have roughly 3 million women each year with an unintended pregnancy. About half of those say in surveys that we've done and some other people have done that they were not using contraceptives when they became pregnant. And that means that the month they became pregnant, they or their partner was using no method. So we've got about 1.5 million pregnancies. Are there women who say that they were trying to use a contraceptive method? And most of those failures come from the most popular reversible contraceptives that require people to be very rigorous about their use. So most of those are from oral contraceptives, condoms, because those are the most popular reversible methods in the country, as well as other methods like periodic abstinence, withdrawal, etc. But what we have is almost 1.5 million pregnancies to women who were using contraception. Now, the fact that so many pregnancies occur to women who say they were not using any method reflects the fact that they have such a high risk of pregnancy when they use no method. If you look at women who are sexually active, could become pregnant if they weren't using a contraceptive and don't want a pregnancy, but 90% of them are using a contraceptive at any one time. So about 1 in 10 are not. And the risk of pregnancy to those women and their partners is so high that 1 in 10 women account for half of the unintended pregnancies. And then among the unintended pregnancies to contraceptive users, there really are two things that can happen. One is that there's a true method failure. What we know is that most contraceptives today potentially are so highly effective that very few pregnancies are because the method itself fails. Most of these are because of difficulties that women and their partners had using methods consistently and correctly. And now you asked about other issues such as not expecting to have sex, such as sexual assault. We don't have good data on all pregnancies. We do have some for those women who go on to have abortions. And it is a percentage, but a small percentage, of women having abortions who had become pregnant because of sexual assault. For most of them, they were contraceptive failures, or they especially were not using a method of contraception during that month and then got caught.
So now we've had a little overview of the U.S. Let's move on and compare unintended pregnancy in the United States to the other developed countries. And I guess the first thing, when I reviewed your study, I was absolutely astonished to see that the birth rate among teenagers is 5 times higher in the United States than it is in Sweden and France. And it's even apparently worse for Japan and Holland. So tell me about that. That's a remarkable statistic.
The rates of teen pregnancy in the United States are among the highest in the Western developed world. And if we compare, for instance, birth rates, in the United States, roughly 4 to 5% of all young women 15 to 19 give birth every year. In Canada, it's less than 2%. In France and in Sweden, it's well under 1% of teenagers. We're probably closest to Great Britain. In England and Wales, it's about 3% of teens who give birth each year. So there are a lot of numbers, but the key pattern is that teenage birth rates in the United States have been higher than most other Western developed countries since the earliest data that we started looking at in the early 1970s. They have started to decrease, and I think many of us have been very pleased with some of the more recent research that has shown that teen birth rates in the United States are among the lowest since 1970. However, they still are much higher than teenagers in other developed countries.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the causes of that. If you don't mind, maybe you could give just a brief statement of why that's important. How birth outcomes among teenage parents compare to other age groups, and why it's not at all an ideal situation to have so many teen pregnancies as we have in the U.S.
Adolescent years are not the safest and best for young women to be giving birth. That's in large part because many of these pregnancies are unintended. Young adolescents having children are more likely to either start prenatal care late, have no prenatal care, and as a result, some of the data show that actually outcomes for their infants are worse than for outcomes for older women. However, the differences that we are really probably most concerned about are the more social and economic differences. The fact that most of the pregnancies and most of the births to adolescents in the United States were not intended. Young women had not wanted to have a child yet. Most of them are to women who are not married, and we know that it's more difficult both for the women and their families, but also for children to be brought up in single-parented families. And the other thing is that having a child in the United States, you know, in the 1700s as an adolescent would have been very common. But in today's society, what that does is it's often linked with disadvantage, poor school performance, difficulty moving then into jobs. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, however, because one of the things that we know is that adolescent pregnancy and especially adolescent births are as much an outcome of disadvantage, of poor economic situations, poor social situations growing up. And it exacerbates the difficulty young women have getting out of those situations, but it's reflecting difficulties in other realms of their lives and a signal of something that we need to both help them avoid and we as a country need to help decrease unintended births and move them to times when women, their partners, and families are better able to care for children and for themselves.
So we have a very high teen birth rate, and one possibility would be that teenage girls in the U.S. are more sexually promiscuous. Is that actually the case?
Well, of course, what does sexually promiscuous mean? So that's one of the areas that we looked at in our study was a sexual activity number of measures across countries. And first of all, what we found is that there are not really large differences in sexual activity across the developed countries. Teens in the United States and actually in United States and Sweden tend to begin having sex a bit earlier than those in Canada, Great Britain, and France. But certainly when you look by the mid-teen and late years, they're quite similar. What we have found, however, is that teens in the United States seem to have shorter, more sporadic relationships than teens in other countries. That may relate to the fact that we not only have a high pregnancy rate in the United States among teens, but also high rates of sexually transmitted diseases.
Higher than the other countries, you're saying?
Yes, yes.
Again, is it a big difference, or how is that?
In the United States, we tend to have higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases among adolescents than adolescents in other countries. And this probably reflects both that adolescents in the United States seem to have more sexual partners, less stable relationships, and we might want to talk about how our societal attitudes may affect that. There's also higher prevalence of many sexually transmitted diseases in our population overall. Rates are higher among older women and men than in other developed countries, as well as in teenagers. And then we probably have less condom use as well for prevention of STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, in the United States.
So first possibility was that our teenagers are more sexually active, and you're saying they're probably not, but they have more partners.
Yes, yes, but sexual activity is not widely different across the countries that we were looking at.
Okay.
But contraceptive use is different, and actually it's quite striking that it looks as though levels of contraceptive use are lower in the United States than among adolescents in the other developed countries we were making comparisons with, and also that women and their partners in the United States are less likely to be using oral contraceptives, which is one of the more effective contraceptives. And also we think, although we're not sure, they may be using them less consistently and less correctly than some of their partners in other countries, so that we think that they probably have higher failure rates even when they do use the pill.
So you're saying there's less use of contraceptives among U.S. teenagers than other developed countries, and especially less use of the most effective contraceptive techniques, hormonal contraception. Mm-hmm. Might this partly reflect a different attitude among American teenagers about whether they actually want to be pregnant? Do American teenagers, are they more likely to actually want to have a baby than in other developed countries?
Actually, the data that we do have from adolescents does indicate that adolescents in the U.S. are more likely to want to become parents as teenagers than teenagers in the key other developed countries that we were looking at. But that's a small amount of the difference, and that most of the difference between pregnancy rates, birth rates in the United States and other developed countries is because teenagers in the United States are much more likely to become pregnant unintentionally.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, our guest has been Jacqueline Derrick, and we've been discussing unintended pregnancy in the United States. After the break, we'll look at the anti-abortion movement, the role of the mass media, and the unique health insurance system of the U.S., and try to understand how each of these seem to factor into the United States having the highest rate of unintended pregnancy and the highest rate of abortion among all the developed countries. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we've been discussing the factors that have made unintended pregnancy and abortion so much more common in the United States than it is in all the other developed countries. Our guest, Jacqueline Derrick, was part of an international team of researchers that has completed its second study comparing teen pregnancy in the U.S. to several other developed countries. Now back to the interview. And what do American teenagers do when they become pregnant unintentionally? Are they more likely to have an abortion than teenagers in other countries? And then do we end up with a higher abortion rate? Mm-hmm. How does that play out?
Teenagers in the United States have higher abortion rates as well as higher birth rates than teenagers in key other developed countries that we were looking at, Canada, Great Britain, France, and Sweden. However, that's not because they're more likely to choose abortion. If they become pregnant unintentionally, teens in the United States are less likely to opt for abortion than, say, a teenager in Canada. But they are so much more likely to have an unintended pregnancy that their overall rate or population rate of abortion is higher. So we have a lot more teenagers in the United States than in Canada who have an unintended pregnancy, while they're less likely than their sisters in Canada to have an abortion. There are so many with unintended pregnancies that the level of abortion in the United States is higher for teenagers than in Canada, in Great Britain, in France, or in Sweden.
So we have the most abortions here in the U.S. because we have the most unintended pregnancies.
We have most abortions in the United States, and it's not only among teenagers, but especially among women in their 20s, because we have high levels of unintended pregnancy. So the key to the problem, if we say, is unintended pregnancy. Why is unintended pregnancy so high in the United States? And the data that we looked at indicate that it's not differences so much in sexual activity, but it's differences in contraceptive use.
How much of the differences among these countries is explained by socioeconomic factors, poverty rates, or racial issues? Do any of the social class or race matter very much? And does it explain the difference between these countries?
It's a good question. How much of the difference between the United States and these other countries is due to differences in poverty, racial differences, makeups of our population? And some of the difference has to do with the diversity of our populations. First thing is that in all the countries that we have looked at, it is those teenagers who are more disadvantaged who have higher teen pregnancy rates and higher teen birth rates. Whether disadvantage is measured in terms of economic disadvantage or social disadvantage. And in the United States, we have actually higher proportions of our population who are disadvantaged than in the other comparison countries that we were looking at. So higher proportion disadvantaged in the United States, higher unintended pregnancies, teen pregnancies among disadvantaged adolescents. But those differences are still not enough to account for the wide gap between the United States and other countries in teen pregnancy and birth rates. And in fact, when we look at higher income teens in the United States, they still have higher pregnancy and birth rates than higher income teens in Western developed countries that we were making comparisons with.
So it sounds like the big factor that accounts for the differences between these various countries in unintended pregnancy is that American teenagers and maybe even women in their 20s are less likely to use effective contraception at times when they do not want to become pregnant. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
So why is that? Yeah, is it because doctors aren't available or they don't have health insurance? What are the reasons?
We identified a number of factors that we think lead to lower contraceptive use rates and lower rates of effective contraceptives in the United States. One actually has to do with the environment, the public support and expectations around adolescence and around transitions to adulthood. Interestingly, one of the things that we found was that compared with the United States, the other study countries are much more likely to have economic and social and health safety net for adolescents as well as for older people and greater incentives and support for becoming parents. Maternal leave and paying for some economic support while you're home with a young child, guaranteeing the ability to go back to jobs, for instance. Other countries are more supportive of parenting, regardless of the age of the parent, than the United States. That this gave young women and young men a greater incentive, actually, to delay childbearing until they were older, until they had finished school, until they had established themselves in the workplace, in part because then the benefits that they would get, like paid maternity leave or paternity leave, would be greater as adults than as young people who did not have that track record in work or employment. So there's greater support for parenthood, but support for that as an adult thing to happen than for adolescents. And that seemed to translate into greater incentive then to delay childbearing. Another thing is that on the one hand, there's support for young people to get education, get employed, become parents, and also a social norm that says once you become an adult, once you have established yourself, have your education, ideally in marital or a cohabiting union, but a union, that's when it's appropriate time to have children. So there's both the support for waiting until later, and there's also the social norm that says that's when you have children, not earlier. Another thing that goes with this support for later childbearing, however, is what looks like a greater society's acceptance of sexual activity among young people, to give young people information and education, whether through schools or other aspects through the society in terms of media, for instance. The way sexuality is treated is much more a matter of course, with the strong social norm that says if you are sexually active, then we expect you to be responsible, not have a child unless you're an adult or in a situation where you can take care of a child. And also, we expect you to prevent sexually transmitted disease among you and your partners. So there's both the greater acceptance of sexual activity and social supports for that, information, education, access to contraception. And there's also a stronger social norm that says sexuality is fine, but prevention of unintended pregnancy or disease is also something that we expect you to do when you're sexually active. In the United States, in contrast, we for many years have been caught up in much more of an argument about whether it's okay for teens to have sex or not, that has kept us from getting into a good discussion of how do we support adolescents who are sexually active in the United States.
In the other countries you studied, in Europe and in Canada, it socially seems to be more acceptable for teenagers to be sexually active in the setting of a committed single relationship. In contrast, in the United States, it's almost as if it's equally bad for an unmarried teenager to be sexually active, whether they have only one partner at all or whether they have 20 partners. That the very act of sex is what's wrong, and it doesn't matter how many partners there are.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have implications on rates of sexually transmitted diseases, among other things.
One of the findings that seemed to emerge from the work that we did with colleagues in these other countries was that in much of Western Europe, for instance, sexuality is more accepted, then the discussions can focus on, so what does it mean to be responsible in that? You can provide information, you provide contraception, you make very clear that that's where the energy of especially the health service is focused. In the United States, we have difficulty getting to that because arguments about sexual activity being good or bad keep the focus on just are you having sex or not, rather than moving in a productive way to recognizing sexual activity occurs among adolescents in the United States like adolescents around the world, and how do we make sure that adolescents are safe and healthy and responsible in terms of dealing with that sexual activity.
In the United States, the age range from 18 to 30 has the highest rate of having no form of health insurance at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in some states, more than a third of young adults have no health insurance. Do you feel that this may be a factor that may lead to the limit, the decreased use of contraception among young people here in the U.S.?
The United States is outstanding in terms of having such a large proportion of our population with no formal means of health insurance.
Outstanding, you mean unusual?
I mean outstandingly bad. Unusual.
Okay.
In Western Europe, for instance, that we look to is similar in many ways. There are economic and social safety nets, and people have health insurance. That means, for instance, that young people have access to contraception as well as other kinds of health care without worrying about the cost of it. And this has really three paths to influencing unintended pregnancy and pregnancy among teenagers. One is the message that it gives about the importance of access to health care, so that for adolescents in the United States, it's harder to find services. Many of the adolescents are obtaining services from family planning clinics, which will provide low-cost services to them. But on the contrary, other adolescents are going to private doctors or no medical services at all and paying for contraceptives on their own and having trouble sometimes doing that. So one cost of the lack of a safety net for healthcare in the United States is more difficulty getting services. Another is that in the United States, since people are less likely to go for kind of ongoing preventive healthcare visits, those conversations that can happen naturally when it's your general healthcare provider who's providing contraception don't happen in the United States. And contraception is much more relegated to special providers than in other European countries. And the third thing that is a bit of a stretch, but I think the data that we came across back it up, that having so many people in our society who are disenfranchised from getting health care coverage does say something to adolescents and to the rest of us about it may not be so important to go for that preventive care, to go for services, because we as a society are not valuing it enough to cover it.
Now, another ramification of the way the U.S. health insurance system is structured is that people who actually do have private insurance generally get that insurance through the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Which adolescents often means through their parents.
Exactly. So their parents might find out if they actually went to a doctor for contraception. Whereas in other countries, health insurance is on the basis of citizenship, and in many of those countries, the health care is free, so their parent may not find out that they're going to a doctor for contraceptive care.
Those are very good points. And in fact, it's something we always have to remember, that even though many people in the United States do have health insurance, that doesn't mean it's easy for young people covered by that health insurance to access reproductive health services. Either the provider may want to involve parents, or the health insurance, the claim may, papers may come back to the parents, or young people may be concerned that it will. That issue has been dealt with in a number of these other countries. In some of them, the identification goes with the young person themselves, so it's not an issue. In others, they made special arrangements so that visits for reproductive health care are treated confidentially with young people. And actually, the confidentiality of services is something that is more and more protected in countries like Sweden, like France, like England, than in the United States. and it goes along with the societal acceptance of sexuality or recognition, I would say, because parents don't always find themselves happy about it, but recognition of sexual activity among adolescents and the decision that the focus should be on contraception and protection against unintended pregnancy.
Does what's taught in the schools seem to make a difference in the interest that teenagers there have in using contraception and also perhaps in their attitude towards sexuality in general?
I think many of us who've grown up in the United States would be surprised to find the extent to which information, education, messages about sexuality, about contraception, are part of school in many other countries. It's not always school. Sometimes it's through the media and other means. But there are two things that we found. One is that in a number of other countries, sexual topics, reproductive health topics, contraception is more likely to be covered in school. Sweden is one of the long-standing examples where actually the focus is very much on interpersonal relationships and healthy relationships, and sexuality is a piece of that. But one of the things that we found was that when information about contraception, about sexual activity is taught in schools in other countries, it's, let's say, is positive about contraception. So it's providing both accurate information and the strong emphasis messages that it is appropriate, it's actually expected for people who are sexually active to use contraception. And with that actually also comes that it's okay to be sexually active, it's okay not to be sexually active, and support for both of those decisions. In the United States, we've got sex education under some form in most secondary public schools. However, it's not universal to be talking about contraception or talking about it in an accurate way, so that young people in the U.S., when they get sex education, are likely to get it late, after they've become sexually active, and many of them don't get accurate information about contraception. The emphasis is, of all of the sex education the teachers that we survey, is on delay or abstinence. The difficulty is that many of the school programs stop there and don't go on to meet the needs and questions of their students about, well, what do you need to do to be prepared when you do have sexual activity.
I believe earlier you brought up the portrayal of sexuality in the mass media in the United States as a potential factor explaining these differences. And I have to say, when I think about that, I think about television or the movies I've gone to. Many times you see a couple starting to become romantic. Sometimes they'll cut the scene off before a lot of clothes are off. But you get the feeling that a lot of those times, they went ahead and probably had sex, even if you didn't get to see it. You usually didn't get to see all of that. But you never see a time when they say, well, do you have condoms? Maybe we kind of shouldn't get so hot and bothered. Are you using an effective contraceptive method? What I'm saying actually seems absurd. I don't know if I've ever seen that kind of discussion in the setting of a romantic encounter on television. And it's even hard to imagine that would ever be depicted. Does that actually happen in other countries, or is it the same everywhere?
Well, a couple of things about mass media. One is that many of the programs and movies from the United States are the same ones that young people are watching in their own countries. However, I'd say two big differences. One is advertising, and the other is programming itself. And the extent to which the real difference seems to be the extent to which in countries other programming, you know, programs of adolescents talking about relationships, programs that portray some of the negative aspects of teen childbearing, and programs that provide more positive images of sexual activities, relationships, including, you know, contraceptive use, are more common in some of the other Western European countries. And the the role of the government has been more on the side of, here's the information about contraception that, or protection against sexually transmitted diseases, condom use, that you need to know. And it's kind of a balance to some of that other programming. Government in France, for instance, did a government campaign on contraception and used television spots to give the message that said something like, contraception, the choice is up to you. You've got a choice about it. But it was about contraception. It wasn't still back in the abstinence argument that we're having here. But the key thing is that the counters to that more casual, explicit images about sexual relationships is more common in other countries.
Which of the developed countries have strong anti-abortion movements?
Well, the opposition to abortion has not been anywhere like the United States in any of the Western European countries. In fact, up until fairly recently, it was pretty much non-existent. There have been some more arguments about abortion or discussions about abortion in France, for instance, but you don't see pickets, you don't see, you know, people shooting providers. I mean, it's not the same situation in other countries. It's one in which abortion is often provided in public facilities, is provided under public health insurance. It's something that happens. It's not necessarily something that people would prefer, but it's not thought about the way it has been historically in the United States.
It seems like having an anti-abortion movement is not an effective strategy to prevent abortion.
Well, it hasn't prevented abortions in the United States either. The fact is that at the Guttmacher Institute, not only comparisons with the United States and other developed countries have been part of the studies, but international studies looking at developing countries as well, and where abortion is often illegal. And one of the strong findings is that the rates of abortion around the world vary primarily by levels of unintended pregnancy, not levels of legality or what women have to do to get abortions. It makes it uncomfortable, difficult, and certainly some people, especially some younger people who would like to have an induced abortion, are not able to in a situation like the United States. But that we still have one of the highest abortion rates in the world among developed countries, and that's because we have such high rates of unintended pregnancy. The answer really is to, if you really want to reduce abortions, and I think most people would concur in that, what you want to do is reduce the chance that a woman will be in a situation where she'll feel that that's her only alternative. And so you want to reduce unintended pregnancy. And that's what these other countries, they have lower birth rates, lower teen birth rates, because they have lower rates of unintended pregnancy among their teens.
I certainly would agree with the statement you just made that it is something that the people who are pro-choice would want, to reduce the numbers of abortions. This is something really everyone wants. The anti-abortion movement would agree with that. So you would think that given the consensus in American society that we would like to reduce the number of abortions, you would think that the kind of systematic study that you're doing would be a real breath of fresh air. And in that spirit, I was wondering if you would maybe summarize what you think the key features are that allow some of these other developed countries to have such low rates of unintended pregnancy and abortion.
Wherever we look, we see that youth who are growing up in conditions of disadvantage, social, familial, economic disadvantage, are most likely to have an unintended pregnancy, to have a birth as a teenager. That's very different from other countries where there's more support for young people as well as adults in terms of health care, in terms of getting good educations, et cetera. And in terms of providing support and assistance for young people to make that transition to adulthood in a healthy way. So one thing is kind of valuing people and helping move them out of disadvantage. Another area is positive attitudes about sexuality and also clear expectations for behavior responsibly in sexual relationships, providing information, education to young people, giving consistent and clear messages about what's appropriate as sexual behavior with the emphasis on contraceptive information and provision of contraception, information through schools, through the media, focusing on being responsible in relationships rather than in the United States where the focus so much has been an argument about abstinence, not about the majority of people who become sexually active as adolescents. The access to contraceptives and other reproductive health services leads to lower teen pregnancy rates, lower unintended pregnancy rates. That means coverage by health insurance so that services are affordable. It means integration of contraceptive services into health care, and it means giving young people the information that they need and access to services so that they can use contraceptives in high levels and use them consistently. So there are a number of things that we can do in the United States that can adapt and adopt some of the paths that we see in other countries that lead to lower teen pregnancy rates.
I was wondering if you could tell us some websites where interested listeners might get more information on the issue of unintended pregnancy.
One good website to look at is the Guttmacher Institute, and that website is guttmacher.org, and that's spelled G-U-T-T-M-A-C-H-E-R. Another website that might be useful for people to look at is called Advocates for Youth, and their website is afy.org for Advocates for Youth. And finally, there has been a fairly active campaign to prevent teen pregnancy in the United States that has a website that can be quite useful, and that website is teenpregnancy.org.
Well, Jacqueline Derrick, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, I've been pleased to talk with you. I hope this spurs you and your listeners to continued interest in, as we work together to try to solve some of these public health problems.
On next week's show, we'll speak with some activists in the pro-life movement and a public opinion researcher to discuss their thoughts on the reasons why the number of abortions in the U.S. is so much higher than in all the other developed countries. And we'll explore where there may be areas of consensus on how to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies and abortions. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.